Okay, so you're at the Climate Action in the Hands of the Courts panel. I'm Carolyn Wetzel. I work for Bloomberg BNA. I work out of California. But we're lucky today to have a great panel to talk about climate litigation. We have on my right Michael Girard from the Sabin Institute, Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law. And then we have Megan Zaronsky, who was Special Assistant and Counsel to President Obama and Senior Policy Advisor for the White House Office of Energy and Climate Change. Can everybody hear me? Is this better? Okay. And Jeff Homestead, down at the end, from Braswell LLP, and he's a former Assistant Administrator for the Office of Air and Radiation at EPA during the Bush administration. What we're going to do is we're going to start off with Michael, who's going to give us an overview of climate litigation. And if Michael and the Sabin Center is not on your source list, it must be. I won't say it's a one-stop place, but it's an important and key stop for keeping up on climate litigation, and they cover a lot of issues, and they even have a blog, one of many law blogs that are important to watch on these cases. I did make copies of a little tip sheet for Michael provided that's on the back table. And the link to this is on the SEJ website under this session. So, Michael, you want to get us started?
Sure. Thank you, Carolyn. So as Carolyn noted, we have a database that tracks all of the climate litigation in the U.S. and a different one that tracks all the climate litigation outside the U.S. And we put out monthly updates, and we have a sheet here for how you can get on those lists. So climate litigation in the U.S. mostly falls into six categories. I'm just going to run through the six categories. The first one is challenges to actions by the Trump administration trying to repeal or delay or stay regulations. Just about everything that is done in that regard is being challenged in court by the environmental community and by the pro-environmental states, usually led by New York and California. Just as during the Obama administration, just about anything they wanted to do was challenged by industry and states like Texas and Oklahoma. So there's a great deal of that litigation happening, and Jeff is going to talk more about that group of litigation. I'll also mention we run another of our websites is the Climate Deregulation Tracker, which posts all of these notices as they come out. The second category is lawsuits for money damages against fossil fuel companies. There were several of those cases 5 or 6 years ago. They were all dismissed. But in the last couple of months, two new clusters of cases have been brought, one by two counties and one city in California, the other by the cities of San Francisco and Oakland. And these suits are mostly asserting common law nuisance, public nuisance claims against the fossil fuel companies. They've been energized in part by recent developments in attribution science, attributing certain climate events to climate change, and also trying to divide up the responsibility of different fossil fuel companies. These cases face a number of legal hurdles before they get to the merits issues on attribution, but I expect that more of those suits are going to be coming in the months to come. The third category, probably the one that has received the most coverage, is the Our Children's Trust cases. This nonprofit group in Oregon has brought quite a few lawsuits around the country based on the public trust doctrine. Most of those have been dismissed, but one of the suits was based not primarily on the public trust doctrine, but primarily on a constitutional claim that there was a federal substantive due process right to a clean environment. That case is called Juliana versus United States, and the federal district court in Oregon has denied a motion to dismiss, ruled that there might be a viable claim, allowed discovery to proceed, and set a trial date for February. However, the Ninth Circuit has stayed this litigation for now. This case would be enormously significant if it were ultimately to win. That is a very big if, and we can discuss that in the Q&A if you would like. The fourth category is suits for failure to adapt to climate change. The Conservation Law Foundation, a nonprofit in Boston, sued Exxon in federal court in Boston, saying that its oil terminal on Boston Harbor had not taken enough precautions against storm surge and other extreme weather events, and that this was a violation of the Clean Water Act and the Oil Pollution Act, which require precautions against this kind of event. The court just a couple of weeks ago allowed the lawsuit to proceed. It denied the portion of the motion to dismiss by Exxon concerning sort of short-term risks and hazards. It dismissed the part of the lawsuit that was seeking relief against things that might not happen until 2050 or 2100. But in view of these three horrible hurricanes that we've had in the last few weeks, where we have, you know, three 500-year storms in short succession, some very serious kinds of developments could happen. So this case is going to proceed, and Conservation Law Foundation has brought another similar case in Rhode Island against Shell. I expect to see quite a few more of these kinds of cases, and we will probably begin to see other kinds of lawsuits over failure to adapt. It wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing lawsuits against architects and engineers and builders who design and build structures that don't withstand foreseeable extreme weather conditions. We've also seen some proceedings against electric utility companies saying that they need to take more precautions to ensure reliability in the face of extreme weather events. The fifth category is lawsuits seeking to compel the consideration of the downstream emissions from fossil fuel extraction. The National Environmental Policy Act, of course, requires environmental impact statements for major federal actions that could have a significant impact on the environment. There have been some recent decisions, which Megan is going to discuss in more detail, ruling for the plaintiffs that in consideration of something like like oil drilling or coal mining, you need to consider not only the direct emissions at the mine or the well, but the emissions resulting from the extraction of the from the emissions from burning the coal and the oil and the gas. Then finally, number six are the Attorney General's investigations of Exxon. The Martin Act is a New York State law that allows the state attorney general to take enforcement action for failures and for securities fraud. Eliot Spitzer, when he was the Attorney General of New York, used that against Wall Street. Andrew Cuomo, when he was the Attorney General of New York, brought a case a few years ago against several electric utility companies and Peabody for failure to disclose. All those were settled. And now Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, is investigating Exxon, inspired in large part by the investigations by Inside Climate News and the LA Times and the Columbia Journalism Review, Columbia Journalism School, which showed that at the same time that Exxon was publicly denying climate change, its own scientists were telling them that it was real. The Massachusetts Attorney General has also started an investigation. Exxon started disclosing a lot of documents to the New York AG, but then Exxon decided to fight back hard. They sued the Attorney General in federal court in Texas, saying that this was an improper investigation, but that suit has now been transferred to New York, which is a much friendlier venue. Congressman Lamar Smith, the chair of the House Science and Technology Committee, had an investigation of the investigation going on last year, which is, so far as I know, has never happened before. And lately, the investigation seems to have turned to the issue of whether Exxon is accurately accounting for the value of its fossil fuel reserves, that if Exxon is going to have to leave a lot of the oil in the ground, its asset base is much smaller than it's what it's reporting to its investors. Schneiderman sought discovery from Exxon's accountants, PricewaterhouseCoopers. That was ferociously litigated, and just a couple of weeks ago, the New York Court of Appeals, the High Court in New York, said that PwC has to make this disclosure. So that the accountant's privilege did not apply here. So we're going to hear a lot more about this Exxon litigation proceeding on multiple fronts. So that's a quick summary of the various kinds of climate litigation happening now in the U.S.
Okay, thank you, Michael. And Jeff, you're going to give us a little briefing on the administration's efforts to repeal, replace, and maybe stay, and including the news of yesterday, today, about the Clean Power Plan. And I think there was even the day before that a court ruling that found that the administration erred in staying the methane rules for drilling on federal lands.
Well, I'll do my best to cover all of that. Because the topic is litigation, I thought I would get into that the topic of these of the litigation over all of these rules. Something that happens to some degree every time there's a change in administrations from one party to the other. Oftentimes there are rules that the first administration has adopted that the new administration is not crazy about. And where litigation is continuing to go on over those rules, when the new administration takes over, the new administration often goes to court and tells the court, hold on a second, we're not sure we want to defend these rules, because EPA is EPA, regardless of whether it's the Obama EPA or the Trump EPA. As a legal matter, the new administration takes the shoes and they can go to the court and say, hold on, put these cases on hold. We're not sure that we want to defend them. This happened to a much greater degree in the last two changeovers than we've seen before. When the Obama administration came in, they used that tactic with a number of George W. Bush administration environmental rules, and this time I think we've seen even a greater number. By my count, there's something like 15 cases where that has happened, and in most of the cases, the court has granted those motions to hold, so the litigation is put on hold while the new administration decides whether it wants to defend those rules or perhaps repeal them or modify them in some way. So there's litigation going on over a number of rules, and I'm not going to try to cover all of them, but I just want to hit the big ones so you have a sense for where these things stand. In my mind, there are really kind of six big rules that are being litigated or where litigation has just recently concluded. There's five. There's a sixth one that is not currently being litigated, and in some ways that may be the most important. The greenhouse gas emission standards, also known as CAFE standards, that the Obama administration promulgated back in 2012. Those rules were challenged, but that challenge was the rules were upheld. And so those rules are in place. They're not under litigation. And there's a question about whether the new administration may try to change those rules in some way. And that's a very interesting topic, but it's not covered by this panel since there's no litigation going on over those rules. The five other rules that I think you probably are aware of if you follow this space, first and foremost is the Clean Power Plan litigation. Then there's another case going on having to do with the standard for new coal-fired power plants, actually new coal and gas-fired power plants. Then there is a series of methane cases that I'm going to lump together. There's the EPA case that regulates methane from new oil and gas operations. There's a couple of BLM rules, including the one that was just decided the day before yesterday. Then there are greenhouse gas emission standards for heavy-duty trucks. And then finally, and in some ways I think interesting to me anyway, is the litigation that has recently been concluded over the Obama administration's efforts to regulate high global warming potential gases under a section of the Act that is deals with ozone-depleting substances. So four of those rules were challenged by the Obama administration, but that litigation has now been put on hold while the new administration decides whether it wants to defend those rules or not. And that litigation is on hold. My prediction is for those four, at least for three of those, it's quite clear that the administration is going to repeal or at least revise, and then that will set off a whole new round of litigation. So it will be essentially the same topic area, but we'll just have people who are on different sides of the cases. I want to just highlight a couple things, and then I want to make sure that we leave plenty of time for Megan, but I do want to just point out a couple of things. The litigation over these rules, at least at this stage, is not over whether they're good policy or bad policy. It's not over whether climate change is real. It's not whether, you know, these are a good idea. The litigation is over whether the government has authority to regulate in this fashion. And that's what the litigation is about over really all of these rules. And the reason I think this is important to notice has to do with this HFC case, and some of you I think have reported on it, but this was a case where virtually everybody agreed that this was a good policy, that there was an effort to phase out these HFCs because they had very high global warming potential. U.S. manufacturers had identified substitutes that they were happy to sell, and so the Obama administration wanted this rule. Most everybody in industry wanted to do this rule. It was actually an effort to implement an international agreement. Well, this rule was challenged by one of the few people who didn't support it. It went to the D.C. Circuit, and the judges basically said, this may be a good policy, but this is something you can't do under this section of the Clean Air Act, because this section of the Clean Air Act was explicitly designed to deal with ozone-depleting substances. And no matter how many people vote in favor of it, if you don't have the legal authority to do it, the rule has to be vacated. So this is actually, in a funny way, an opportunity where there could actually be climate change legislation, because I think Congress might step in and actually codify what was struck down, which is completely illegal. But I do think for many people who are big supporters of the Clean Power Plan, and I know that there are at least two of them to my left, I think that rule would have suffered a similar fate. And we can talk about that, but that's why the question of what an agency's legal authority is really important. And we will be talking about that both in the rulemaking context and then in litigation probably for at least the next 3 years on the Clean Power Plan, dealing with coal-fired power plants primarily, dealing with methane emissions from oil and gas operations, and maybe over these truck GHG standards.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Megan, do you want to go ahead and talk about the NEPA claims? Thanks.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm going to try to be really quick on NEPA because the Clean Power Plan revocation plan leaked this morning, and that's probably much more interesting for all of us to talk about than cases that have been over for at least a few days. So let me be very succinct. I mean, I think we've seen a consistent theme in the court decisions since the Trump administration took over. It's
move
a fairly
move closer.
Can you all not hear me?
Just get closer.
Looks like you can hear me.
Yeah.
Okay,
we're recording. So.
Oh, you're recording.
Yeah.
Well, then I'll get further from the mic. So you know, there have been a series of court decisions that have basically said, "Hi, you have to follow the law." That's kind of been the gist of what these decisions have been. You saw that when EPA tried to stay the carbon pollution standards, methane, in this case, methane pollution standards for the oil and gas sector. The D.C. Circuit struck that down, saying you did not do this according to the authority that you had, and you have to have authority if you want to stay something. And then we saw the same thing with the Bureau of Land Management effort to stay the methane waste rule for federal lands, which again, the court said you didn't follow the procedures that give you the authority to stay rules. This did not fit within that authority, and so we are vacating the stay. And you've also seen this this pattern in a couple of cases under the National Environmental Policy Act, which basically says, agency, if you are doing a federal action, you have to take a really hard look at the environmental implications of that action. And what a hard look means, you know, this is not super specific language. You have to think about it a little bit. And so we've seen a series of cases where the courts and the agencies are kind of wrestling with what that means. So we had the Wild Earth Guardians case, which is actually in the 10th Circuit, where you had a couple of environmental groups challenging the Bureau of Land Management's approval of extensions to a series of Powder River Basin coal leases, which would expand the mine's potential to extract coal under what had been sort of prior leases covering adjacent land. And the Bureau of Land Management did in this case what it has actually fairly frequently done and said, if we look at not issuing these leases and we look at issuing these leases, the effect on the world is the same in terms of greenhouse gases, because if we don't burn this coal, we'll burn some other coal. They call this the perfect substitution theory. And the court said, basically, that is illogical, because the agency, this perfect substitution is arbitrary and capricious because the assumption itself is irrational. It's basic, you know, supply and demand, that if you have less supply with the same demand, prices are going to change, and that might actually affect the balance of energy generation in this country. So that one was sent back for the court to the district court to decide what the remedy was going to be. Similar case, Montana, some environmental groups challenged an approval of a federal mining plan modification for some coal surface mines near Billings. And in that case, the Office of Surface Mining had failed to consider two things in its environmental assessment. They hadn't looked at the environmental impacts of transporting the coal by rail, so the diesel emissions and the coal dust impacts. And although they looked, actually, they talked a lot about the greenhouse gases that would be burned or that would be produced when the coal was combusted, they didn't say what the impacts of combusting that coal would be in terms of greenhouse gases, and specifically they refused to use the social cost of carbon to put a value on what those climate impacts would be. At the same time, they had put a monetary value on jobs that would be created and royalties that would be generated if this mining plan was adjusted, and the court here, they said it's illogical to look at the benefits of something and not to look at the costs, or, you know, you can flip those two depending upon which framework you're looking at. But again, here the court zeroed in on this idea that it doesn't matter if we do this or not, because if we don't adjust this plan, the same amount of coal is going to be burned anyway from somewhere else. And the court just said that just fails basic economics, so you can't do that. And you should use the social cost of carbon. Then the third case was a Sierra Club challenge to a FERC decision. FERC approved a natural gas pipeline. And FERC said, we don't have to think about the greenhouse gases associated with the gas that's going to go through this pipeline, because it's not really our business. Like, we're FERC, we do energy, we don't have to do these environmental implications things, and there are all of these other things that have to happen for this pipeline to go through. So even, you know, our approval is sort of not the final cause of these greenhouse gases, so we're not going to use the social cost of carbon, and we're not going to look at these emissions. And the D.C. Circuit said, you have, in this particular case, your authority is broad enough where you could reject this pipeline application based on the environmental harms caused by the combustion of the natural gas. And given that you have that authority to reject this pipeline, you have to look at those environmental harms, and you have to tell us why the social cost of carbon is not a useful means of looking at the environmental impacts there. So that's a brief overview of the less interesting world of NEPA than the other things that are happening today.
All right, so let's talk about the Clean Power Plan proposal, or absent proposal, I guess, that was announced yesterday or this morning, or
well, not announced,
it's
just leaked.
I think most of us here probably have a copy. I think they will formally put it out today now that it's widely available. But so, yeah, I think all of us up here and many people in the room probably got it around, 11 o'clock this morning. So we now have a copy of their proposal to repeal the Clean Power Plan. And truly, there's nothing terribly surprising in the proposal. They essentially, what they do is say, we believe that because this is now EPA speaking again, that the earlier Clean Power Plan went beyond EPA's legal authority because it went beyond the things that could be done to reduce the emission rate of an individual plant. And I have to say I have great respect for the EPA staff because they have done just as good a job with this as they did with the original Clean Power Plan, and it's actually quite a comprehensive discussion of all the reasons why, and they look not only at the words of the statute, but they look at the legislative history, and they look at the structure of the act, and they look at various other policy considerations, and so they give sort of five separate reasons why they believe that the earlier Clean Power Plan was beyond EPA's authority. And really what it comes down to is this basic question of whether under this particular part of the act, EPA is allowed to essentially to tell owners of power plants that they have to shut down their plants and have some mechanism to ensure that electricity is produced by other less polluting plants, or whether what EPA is limited to doing is requiring a particular facility to make a physical or operational change to that facility to reduce its emissions when it's operating. So we have the proposal. I think the most, to me, interesting thing is one of the big questions has been whether they are going to replace the Clean Power Plan with something else. I think for legal reasons that they would be much better off to issue a replacement rule. But in this particular proposal to repeal, they very clearly said, well, that's still up in the air. At one point I had the language here, but it's a sentence that will be widely quoted where it basically says, well, we're considering whether to do this. We may or we may not. We're going to issue a separate advance notice of proposed rulemaking to ask the questions of whether we should replace it, and if so, how we should go about doing that. So we have a proposal to repeal. Probably early next week we'll have an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, and my prediction is sometime after that we'll have a new proposed rule to come up with a Clean Power Plan replacement rule, and then there will be a final rule, and then there will be more litigation.
So I know, Megan, you want to respond to this too, but I also want to get to the potential legal implications if there is no rule.
Well, let's. I think that's a really interesting question that we should definitely talk about. But maybe first, I completely agree with Jeff that there's nothing interesting in the legal rationale for where they're headed on the Clean Power Plan revocation.
These arguments have been made for at least 3 years.
We've been briefing this for a long time, and they've just flipped sides on the brief. So we've seen all of these arguments about whether or not the best system of emission reduction that EPA identified in the Clean Power Plan is within the statutory language. Very well reasoned in the briefs. You can look at them and come up with your own opinions. But I do think there's a lot of really interesting, I'll use that neutral word, stuff that's in the document that leaked today that is worth taking a very close look at. And it's all in the discussion of what the regulatory impact analysis of repealing the Clean Power Plan is going to say. And that document isn't out yet, but the summary of it shows some very unexpected moves. So three things to look for. When the Clean Power Plan was finalized, EPA looked at the costs and benefits of the rule and had net benefits of $26 to $45 billion per year in 2030 on an annual basis. That's obviously an inconvenient fact if you are looking to undo the Clean Power Plan, that it's delivering those kinds of benefits to Americans, both on the climate side, reductions of climate pollution, but also on the side of reducing co-benefits. So when you reduce carbon emissions from power plants, you also end up reducing NOx, SOx, and particulate matter emissions. And those benefits were also very, very large. What you'll see in the document that leaked today is they have done some very dramatic revisions to both the cost numbers and the benefit numbers. On the cost number side, the way EPA usually does a cost-benefit analysis of the rule is they model that sector in a world without the rule, and then they model that sector in a world with the rule, and the difference between those two modeling runs are your compliance costs. That's what EPA did the first time around. What they have done here is they have modeled the costs of the rule, and then they have done an estimate of how much power generation would occur if the energy efficiency that is going to be driven by the rule hadn't taken place. And then they do an estimate of how much generating that electricity would cost. And then they add that number to the compliance costs. And then they add that same number to the benefits costs because they say this should be a benefit. We should look at this not as avoided costs the way we did the first time, but we should look at this as a benefit. So the net between the costs and benefits of that entire exercise is zero. You have no change to the net cost-benefit number. But what you do have is now a spectacularly large cost number. So we have gone from an $8 billion rule to a $33 billion rule, which may have some political implications. The two other things that they've done on the benefit side, and here I'm very confident that Jeff and I will disagree. So Jeff will tell you the other side of this, but they've done two very one of these things we knew was coming. The other one is a little bit of a shock. They've adjusted the social cost of carbon number, which is the estimate of our best guess of how much reducing a ton of carbon pollution is going to save us in terms of the avoided climate harms to society. And they have used what they're calling a domestic social cost of carbon value, where they're trying to limit this estimate to just things that would happen within the borders of the United States. Generally speaking, economists will tell you we don't actually have models that can generate a domestic social cost of carbon number. So they've done some, they've had to create some assumptions in order to get to that number. The other thing that folks in the social cost of carbon world and economists will say is if you're dealing with a global environmental problem, you have to look at the value to the globe of reducing emissions if you want everyone on board in order to actually get you to a solution, A. And B, there's no way to actually isolate these impacts outside of the United States because, you know, Department of Defense has been very clear. They see climate change as a very significant risk to our security because if you destabilize other countries because of, you know, very intense climate impacts, that can destabilize societies and governments, which can lead to mass migration, which can lead to terrorism potential. Also, you know, the governments or the economies of the world fairly interconnected these days. So, again, if you have massive economic collapse in, say, Greece, that has, you know, reverberations for the rest of the economy. So that's the social cost of carbon. That was not a surprise. We saw that in the proposal to delay the Bureau of Land Management's methane waste rule. They also used this domestic value there, so we knew that was coming. The other thing they have done, which is truly spectacular, is they have done what they are calling sensitivity analyses on the benefits of reducing the small particulate matter, so PM2.5. This is the really tiny particulate matter. Mm-hmm. Particulate matter is, in exposure, is very harmful to folks who have cardiovascular disease and who have lung disease, also to children and the elderly. You have chronic impacts on children's lung development and lung function due to exposure to PM2.5, and you also have very significant premature mortality. It leads people to die sooner because of the exposure to PM2.5. And they have, in this rule, they have, in these two sensitivity analyses, they have cut off the benefits for reducing PM2.5 once an area is in attainment with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for particulate matter for 2.5. The trouble is those standards are not set at a level that eliminates the risk from PM2.5, and we have copious scientific research, including research that is quoted in this document, that documents these causal relationships between exposure to PM 2.5 and premature mortality at levels well below where the NACS currently is, which is at 12 micrograms per meters cubed. They're showing, you know, effects all the way down to in the 5 to 8 range, and that's the lowest range that was evaluated in these studies. So they just said, if you're in attainment with the NACS, we're giving zero value to lives lost and to health impacts caused by PM exposure, and therefore zero value to avoiding that PM exposure through the Clean Power Plan emission reductions. The second sensitivity analysis that they do does a similar thing where they're cutting off benefits below the values observed in those two studies. So again, even though EPA has a number of times, including as recently as April of last year, said we don't see any threshold effect with PM 2.5, the scientific research does not support that there is a level as getting down to very close to background levels, background level concentrations, that shows that we are not having this kind of harm occur. Nonetheless, they've completely cut it off at that level and said we're giving no value to reducing these pollutants and therefore these lives saved and avoided health harms. When you do all of those things and you add them together, you can say, look, the Clean Power Plan doesn't actually do anything for the world because we've completely sort of tried to take these massive benefits that the Clean Power Plan would have delivered and made them look very, very small on both the climate side and on the co-pollutants side, which, of course, is very convenient if you are trying to undo the Clean Power Plan. But it is, in my opinion, a travesty in terms of what the EPA is supposed to be doing, which is protecting human health and welfare under the Clean Air Act. But those are all things that you should take a very, very careful look at. Sure. I know Jeff will have another look tonight.
I just wanted to make one other comment on the legal implications of the announcement today. I mentioned the lawsuit several years ago seeking money damages or injunctive orders against fossil fuel companies and electric utilities. The principal reason those cases were dismissed was that EPA was getting ready to regulate greenhouse gases, and the argument was it's not the job of the courts to determine the appropriate level of greenhouse gas emissions. It's EPA's job, and EPA is doing the job. If EPA is not doing a job, if EPA disavows any interest in regulating greenhouse gases, it creates an argument that these kinds of theories should come back. There are counter arguments that some language in the relevant Supreme Court decision prevents these cases from going forward as long as EPA has the authority to act, whether or not they are acting. But I'm sure that we will see this come up in the new lawsuits that I mentioned have been filed and additional lawsuits that may be coming against fossil fuel companies. The separation of powers issue is going to be central to those cases, and EPA's retreat from regulating greenhouse gases will be relevant to that separation of powers argument.
Go ahead, Jeff.
So I agree completely with everything Michael said, which is a reason why I'm a little surprised that they've still left open the possibility that they may not do anything. So that's, you know, that wasn't what I was expecting, in part for that very reason. With regard to what Megan said, it is impressive how much you know before the RIA is released. I haven't actually read this, even the summary yet, because I came in here. But I do want to give you at least a slightly different perspective on PM 2.5. And this is a topic that deserves much more discussion, actually. But in the Obama administration, there was a very comprehensive scientific process that was overseen by Gina McCarthy and before that by Lisa Jackson, by Obama appointees, and they looked at this issue of PM 2.5, and they said if the level in a city is 12 micrograms per cubic meter or less, public health is protected with an adequate margin of safety. So the question is, if that conclusion is true, which is not the George W. Bush administration, but the conclusion, and by the way, they what they really said is there may be benefits, there may be harms below this level, but they're too uncertain for us to set a standard at this level. And so in light of that finding, there's been an ongoing question for a while now as to whether EPA can say that on one hand, and then on the other hand say, no, but there are tens of thousands of people who are dying every year because they're exposed to levels that are below 12 micrograms per cubic meter. So there is, and I don't necessarily want to get into the science, but in terms of the rationale for doing the analysis that way, that's an important issue. It's been around for a long time. But I do want to go back to the HFC case because of an executive order, they are required to do a cost-benefit analysis for any rule of this type. And administrations, Republican and Democrats, have been pretty good about doing that. But if EPA doesn't have legal authority to do this, then the fact that there may be benefits greater than the cost is not legally relevant. Similarly, one of the arguments that has been made against the ozone standard is cost-benefit analysis in the past have shown that the cost of the rule is greater than the benefits, and yet EPA still, because of the way the statute works, says, well, we're going to set the level here even though we think the costs of this rule are greater than the benefits. So Megan and I have had discussions over these issues for a while, but I do want to make sure people have that context, that it's not quite the same way, perhaps, that she presented it.
Okay, so we can go now. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask about is this administrative process that is involved in repealing or replacing or revising rules. The Trump administration has been caught up in a couple of cases already on the way they've proceeded. So do you see them learning from this lesson, or, how is that going to work going forward? Michael, would you like to say something, or Jeff? Or?
I guess I'm not yet seeing a lot of learning going on. Jeff, I don't know if you have any views on that.
What I will say is that the early staffing of the administration has been different from what we've seen before. I was involved in the last two Bush administrations. I was involved in the Romney campaign, and in those more traditional campaigns, there were people involved with the election effort that had experience in these issues and essentially were prepared to step in as people who had experience in the issues and who could come into the agencies very quickly. The Trump administration was unconventional, and it didn't really have that set of people. And I think that's understandable, but to me, more concerning has been it's taking them a very long time to nominate people who have experience with these issues. So I think it's a fair criticism that at EPA, perhaps because they didn't really have a lot of experience with these issues, they did some things that were legally vulnerable, primarily on process grounds. I mean, these three, that's not true on the NEPA, but those were not Trump administrations. Those were Obama decisions that were overturned. Or Bush, okay. Are they that old?
They're really old.
but I will just point out that some very fine people have finally been nominated, a new general counsel, a new head of the air office, head of the water office, and head of the toxics office, all had their confirmation hearings this past Wednesday. I believe there will be a vote out of committee on the 18th or the 19th, and so soon they will have a full contingent of people in place who I think are much more familiar and who will be very careful to make sure that they follow the procedural requirements. And again, if you read the proposal that either has or has not been announced yet, you will see it's pretty carefully written. So obviously someone has paid much more attention to making sure that the procedural issues are going to be taken care of.
Well, now we're ready to take your questions. So do I have any questions here? Go ahead. And first, let me just reiterate, SEJ members first.
The way that what has been put out was carefully written,
but the Trump administration is lacking the expertise. Where do you think are the roots of what's been written? You know, what is its sort of history coming in?
Let me repeat the question. Where do you, in terms of this Clean Power Plan leak document, where are the roots of what was written?
They really come out of the legal arguments that have been developed on both sides of the question for the last many years. It looks to me like the EPA staff, career staff officials, had a role in drafting the documents. It's written in sort of the style that they would write it in, and it's written with the kind of care that they would write it in. So, however, the policy decisions, the decision to adopt those arguments, clearly comes from the EPA administrator. I don't think there's any question about that. And other officials within the administration, you know, we talk about EPA doing something, but in any administration, on these big issues, there's collaboration between the White House and the Office of Management and Budget and the agency head. So clearly the policy decision was made, and certainly they had some role in developing the legal arguments, but I suspect ultimately the drafting was done by people at EPA.
Okay, Justin?
Yeah, Justin Grierson, Green Energy based in California. We're doing a carbon impact statement.
Okay, going forward, how will the administration account for greenhouse gas emissions for projects going forward under NEPA?
Yeah, it's a slightly different question, I think, was asked.
Oh, was it? Okay, good.
So what's the legal status of it, which is different from how the administration will account for it.
Okay.
Yeah, they withdrew the NEPA guidance, which I have to tell you, the agencies really, really wanted the NEPA guidance, kind of for the same reasons that we've just seen with this series of litigation, where they take an action, they're going through their NEPA process, they do something, and then the court, you know, says that was not sufficient. And so if they have guidelines, then it's easier to standardize your review and make sure that you are, you know, properly following your requirements under NEPA. The fact that the guidance was withdrawn didn't make it disappear from the world, so I think folks could probably still go out and find it and follow those processes and then probably do a better job in court. As Jeff noted, some of these things happened under the Obama administration when there was clearly, from the sort of head of the administration, from the White House, a desire to have a very rigorous analysis of greenhouse gas impacts of actions that were taken, which didn't necessarily mean that actually happened at the end of the day. And that's, you know, going to be true for any administration. It's very hard to get consistency in these things across the government. I also think we're at a really, it creates a very interesting political challenge for this administration, which does not want to talk about climate change and does not want to act on climate change, which means that even though Jeff may be advising them to put in place a replacement rule for the Clean Power Plan, which is probably good advice, that's hard for them to do because then they are putting in place a rule to address greenhouse gas emissions. Similarly, when they are evaluating the impacts of expanding a coal mine, it is not going to be easy for them to put out a formal document that says the greenhouse gas implications of us expanding this coal mine are going to create all of these harmful climate impacts, right? There is tension there between the tone that is being set from the White House and what you are required to do under the law. And I'm personally very interested to see how that tension is resolved or not as we, you know, see more of these actions and they get challenged.
Can I just add, before the CEQ guidance was issued in late 2015, there were several court decisions saying that even without guidance, it's necessary to look at greenhouse gas implications under NEPA. That is still the case. As Megan said, there have been several decisions under NEPA calling for that greenhouse gas analysis even after the rescission of the guidance. So the guidance provided guidelines on how to do it, but there still absolutely will be legal challenges, some of which might be quite successful, saying that they had to do the analysis anyway.
Can I just one last thing on this one, because it is important. You have to remember that the companies that have invested time and effort and millions of dollars in these projects, they don't necessarily have, they just want to get their permissions. And so I suspect that what you will see is that and to some extent this is the way NEPA works now, is that the companies pay for consultants usually to do the work, and at least estimating the greenhouse gas effects of these projects is not. It does require some sophisticated modeling, but contrary to what Megan said, the fact that it doesn't mean that you reduce global greenhouse gases by whatever this project would provide. It means that you would have a very, very small price impact. And the question is, if you increase the price of coal by 0.0001%, what would that do in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions? And consultants have models that look at that. So I guess this is a long way of saying what will happen, in my view, is that the companies who are trying to get approvals for pipelines or expansion of coal mines will provide this kind of analysis that the agencies will then use. And I suspect that, and whether they use the Obama guidance or something else, they clearly have an interest in making sure that analysis is done.
Okay, another question we had over here. You, yeah. Go ahead. Okay, this is on the prospects of the success of the Our Children's Trust case. So I'll let you talk about that.
So the plaintiffs in the Giuliana case are seeking a court order that the federal government take much more vigorous actions to fight climate change. The Trump administration so far has said that the responding to the discovery request would be excessively onerous. I don't think that necessarily flies, and I don't think the district court believes that that flies. But on the underlying issue of whether there is a constitutional right to a clean environment, which no U.S. federal court had ever previously declared, and whether the power to set national climate policy should be transferred to the courts. The fact that the Ninth Circuit issued a stay is not a good sign for the plaintiffs. And I have to say, I find it difficult to find 5 votes on the United States Supreme Court to support the theory that the plaintiffs are using in the Giuliana case. So if the case does survive in the Ninth Circuit and there's a judgment against the U.S. government, it will highly likely go to the Supreme Court, and I just don't see the 5 votes for it to survive at that level.
I'm not even sure I see 1 or 2 votes. I mean, it is a pretty extraordinary, and not only recognizing a constitutional right, but then a cause of action to enforce that right in courts. It's so. I.
Megan, you have any comment?
Well, just to get to the other part of your question, which was, what would it look like if they won? They are seeking basically a very, very high level counsel within the government that is going to figure out how the government can act to really, really sort of effectively reduce greenhouse gas emissions on the scale that science tells us is imperative if we're going to avoid the worst climate impacts. So that is, and it's maybe helpful to remember, they brought this case against the Obama administration. So the Climate Action Plan and all of the actions that the Obama administration were taking, to their minds, and I have some sympathy for this, were totally insufficient to deal with the scale of the problem. But if you think about that court order going into place with this administration, I have no idea what would happen.
It's interesting because I think the conclusion would be, and Megan may not agree with this, but the conclusion of this council would be, all these things need to be done, but we need congressional action to do it. And therefore, would you be calling on Congress to pass new laws to implement this judgment from? Now, if it's from the Supreme Court, then that would create some interesting issues too. But it's a,
and if it's constitutional,
and if it's
no,
right.
I mean, if it's
right.
A constitutional obligation, then a court could order it without congressional action.
I have a hard time seeing a court designing the.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Anyway, it would be very interesting.
Okay, let's we'll start with the white shirt.
This is for Megan, and I'm going to look foolish asking it. I was impressed with the way you laid out several areas of concern. Early on in your litany of concerns was one that appeared to disconcert you so much that you sort of laid it out and then moved on. And I was trying to wrap my head around it while you stewed it on. So can I ask you, I mean this genuinely, I'm confused. Could you go back to the one that you felt was most concerning and explain it again?
Do you remember which one it was?
I'm sorry.
I think so. There were maybe it was the PM.
So there were three. There was the energy efficiency costs, the social cost of carbon, and then the particulate matter benefits.
Wasn't the particulate matter, and I don't think it was the
second costing benefits.
So you think it was the energy efficiency piece? Sure, I will try. This is it's very confusing. It's very confusing. I had a bit of an advantage because it's possible that folks wanted this to happen earlier in the world, and it didn't. So what they have done is they are arguing, I'm going to start from the conclusion, they are arguing that the money that we save by not generating electricity because we've improved our energy efficiency, when you do the cost-benefit analysis of a rule, you have to look at that as a benefit rather than an avoided cost. So what they... So when you do the cost-benefit analysis of a rule, you basically add up the costs on one side, and then you add up the benefits in another column, and then the difference between those two numbers is your net costs or your net benefits. So what they have done is they have – their justification for what they did is that you have to think of the avoided costs because we didn't generate a bunch of electricity because we improved our energy efficiency because of the Clean Power Plan. There is a causal relationship, and that's where I should have started. That's where I lost you. The Clean Power Plan allows a ton of flexibility in terms of how it is complied with, how you get those emission reductions. So you can shift your generation from higher emitting sources to lower emitting sources. You can also invest in energy efficiency. Exactly. And if you invest in energy efficiency, you don't have to generate as much electricity, which means you don't have as much emissions. And it is by far the most cost-effective way to reduce emissions. So EPA's compliance analysis said we're going to see a lot of energy efficiency happen. So what they then did in this particular case is they modeled the world of the power sector with the Clean Power Plan. And they saw how much the power sector had to pay to generate the electricity that was needed and as clean as was required by the Clean Power Plan. And then they projected how much electricity you would have needed to generate if all of the energy efficiency that happened had not happened. And then they projected how much it would have cost to generate all of that imaginary electricity. And they added that number to the cost side. And then they added the same number to the benefit side, which means your net, I know it's very strange, your net cost benefit number has not changed, but your costs are now massive. Because in addition to the actual power sector's costs of complying with the Clean Power Plan and providing everyone with electricity.
Are they double counting costs?
They're counting costs that are not real. And they're putting them on the benefit side and on the cost side. They're not real. The electricity is never going to be generated. You're never going to have to pay for it. It's not real.
So one of the 27 issues that will be litigated when this is inevitably sued.
Well, maybe not because it's just the RIA, but it has,
The RIA that hasn't been published yet.
Oh, it's in what came out this morning.
The RIA is?
No, the summary of it.
And they actually go through that?
Yeah.
Okay, Clint. First, yes. Please identify yourself.
Yeah, Clint Wilder with Clean Edge. Jeff, at the beginning, you mentioned that the six Obama rules, and you said 3 to 4 of them expect to be revised or replaced. We've seen, now we know what their intention is with CPP. What form will the others take? Will it be similar to what EPA, new rules for EPA? Will it be executive order?
So all of these things would have to be done by rulemaking. I think the other ones are not going to be nearly as dramatic. For example, I think with methane emissions from new oil and gas operations, you know, there's litigation over that. That litigation has been stayed. They've been tried to delay those rules. But I think ultimately they will leave most of the requirements in place, but just revise some of the requirements that the industry feels is unreasonably burdensome. So I don't think that's going to be such a dramatic change. And we could go through each one. So the other place where I think you will see a big change is the emission standards for new coal-fired power plants, because the Obama administration found that carbon capture and sequestration had been adequately demonstrated, and therefore any new coal-fired power plant would need to install carbon capture and storage. For various reasons, I think they will change that and say, no, we disagree, it hasn't been adequately demonstrated. But in terms of real-world impacts, you know, folks with the price of natural gas, people are not looking to build new coal-fired power plants. So I don't. In terms of practical impacts, changes to the methane rule, I think, will not be that significant. Changes in the 111B rule that will not be that significant. It'll be interesting to see what they do with the truck greenhouse gas standards. I don't predict that we will see huge changes there either. So, you know, the one that has appropriately gotten all the attention is the clean power plant. And I mean, and Megan knows some of these rules better than I do. There's the methane. There's two other methane rules, and I like to think that I'm an EPA expert, but I don't really understand exactly what BLM has done on those rules. And those, I think one of them may just be eliminated because of legal issues, and the other one I don't know as much about. But those the other ones are not going to be nearly as significant as the Clean Power Plan.
Well, and the CAFE standards, if they decide to change the CAFE standards, and especially if they decide to try to revoke the California waiver, that would be extremely significant and hotly contested.
And let me just make an observation, if I can, about that. This is one that's been very interesting because the administration signaled fairly early on that they were prepared to significantly change those standards because they thought they were overreaching. The industry has really lobbied for a much more moderate approach, and so I ultimately will see how that all plays out. I don't want to say there's no way there'll be a fight between California and the administration. It could still come to that, but and I don't represent any auto manufacturers, but my impression is they would very much like to preserve a single standard that applies in California and the rest of the country. They don't necessarily want litigation if the Trump administration revokes the California waiver, because that creates uncertainty for them, which is difficult when you're, you know, making these massive investments. So my impression about that one is, you know, in fact, I think they basically said they would like some more compliance flexibility, but I don't know that we will see significant changes to the CAFE standards for that reason.
Okay. Dean and then Dean first.
Dean and then Dean. Just as an aside, Jeff, I was talking to someone about this the other day, and depending on how this worked out in terms of what EPA was going to put forward in terms of options. As a political matter, it seems like Pruitt is always rumored to be running for Senate. Conceivably, if he did what you're suggesting, he'd be running a campaign in which he was actually regulating greenhouse gas emissions among those options, which would just be fascinating to watch him run in a campaign against someone that's running to the right of him, saying, you know, you're sort of a climate environmentalist at that point, moving the climate regulation forward. And my question is, I guess I may not have heard this come up, about mass EPA, but I'm sort of stunned at how many times I don't hear that brought up in the context of this, and I wonder if you could provide some guidance maybe to reporters who are following this in the trenches, but you get this feeling that we're all going through this process, so at the end of the day, the Supreme Court, and we know where they line up on these issues, kind of, are going to make a decision. You know, is this Trump approach legal? Or does it not go far enough? But in the end, we're all waiting for this arbiter at the end is really just going to decide these things, regardless, in a way, of what administration comes along and puts forth a specific proposal. Should we look at it that way, or am I missing
that? Well, I'll give a quick answer, and I think that's a vast oversimplification. Ultimately, the Supreme Court plays a very important role, but that doesn't mean that they design the regulations. So I believe that had the Clean Power Plan made it to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court would have said, EPA, you've gone beyond your statutory authority, go back and try again. And then it's up to the agency to try to fashion a new rule that complies with the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Clean Air Act. And so I think ultimately that's what you're going to see in this litigation, and you know how far it goes remains to be seen. But I think it's an exaggeration to say ultimately this is up to the Supreme Court, because you know they've said to EPA, you have authority to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. Now you go figure out how to do it. And then each time you do a rule, it gets challenged through the court system again. And a few of those rules may make it to the Supreme Court, but not very many.
Yeah, I think if this gets to the Supreme Court is likely to rule on fairly narrow grounds about whether it was within the statutory authority. I don't necessarily agree with Jeff that it would be doomed at the Supreme Court if it went there, but I think it'll be based on fairly narrow statutory authority and regulatory interpretation issues, rather than saying, we said in Massachusetts you have to regulate greenhouse gases, you haven't done enough, you have to do a lot more. I don't see them coming out that way.
But at the same time, sort of the foundation of your question, that Massachusetts is what this all comes back to at the end of the day, is right, not in that the Supreme Court will be evaluating policies for how well they've fulfilled their policy objectives, but in the sense that they have said EPA has an obligation to address this pollution under the Clean Air Act. And so whatever happens over the next few weeks, months, 3.5 years, that obligation remains, and that will be enforced at the end of the day. They do have to act.
And the Supreme Court may move to the right, depending on changes in personnel over the balance of the Trump term.
Okay. It's not going to move to the left.
Jeff, I believe you said that any kind of sort of legal clumsiness that we've seen in these first several months, that might become less of a thing once more appointees make it through the confirmation process and the EPA is just more fully staffed. So I wanted to make sure I got that right, and if so, would you just talk more about that? I'm curious if you do agree.
Okay, these are Jeff's comments about staffing, so...
So I think the question is whether some of the early cases in which Trump administration actions have been struck down in court, whether that's indicative of what we'll see for the rest of the administration, or whether that those are sort of growing pains, and I really do believe that as they are now getting people in place who really have expertise with these issues, that they will be more careful. And for the most part, these decisions have rested on procedural issues, right? I mean, that's the case with the two stay decisions, that you didn't go through notice and comment. Making sure that that people understand all the procedural requirements is something that I think these new people will help with. But I also think that the administrator Pruitt and others are realizing that as well, that they, you know, he was not an administrative lawyer, but he himself, I think, is now aware of that. So I don't think we'll see those kinds of court cases in the future.
Not all Trump administration declarations result from meticulous staff work. And we don't know what the future will bring. Certainly the order that Secretary of Energy Perry issued last Friday on grid resiliency did not reflect a lot of careful staff work, and I think it's already imploding on its own weight. So I don't know what the future will bring.
And I would just add that even if things are done more carefully in the future, which I agree is likely, there will be fundamental questions of whether or not the things that this administration tries to do actually comply with the law. And we had some of those fundamental questions under the Obama administration, and I think we will have them similarly from sort of a different perspective under this administration. So we'll see what happens.
Well said.
Okay, any other questions?
Well, it certainly played a role in the litigation we've already had over the Clean Power Plan, because we went into court a year ago, which breaks my heart, and argued this case, and there were basically two worldviews that were presented to the D.C. Circuit. One worldview said what EPA is doing here is a massive power grab. They are interfering with the state's authority to manage their own energy policy, and if you let them do this, the end of the world is nigh. They could do anything in terms of requiring people to stop producing various products. The other worldview that was presented to them was, this is the way the power sector works. When the power sector is balancing supply and demand, which they have to do continuously, you're constantly shifting generation from one source of generation to another. And by the way, when power companies comply with air pollution rules, this is generally what they do. They shift from their higher emitting sources to their lower emitting sources whenever they're given the chance to comply doing that. And the fact that the world was moving in this direction and you were seeing these shifts already happen was helpful for the court to understand, if you buy my perspective of the world, that what EPA was doing was not crazy and invasive. It was simply going along with the trends that it was seeing in the world. We have since seen those trends accelerate. There's a new report out this week from the Institute of Policy Integrity showing a series of independent analyses of what it would cost to achieve the Clean Power Plan's emission reductions, all of which are showing, because we're seeing more natural gas generation because of the low cost of gas and more renewable deployment because of falling costs of renewables and the tax credits, it's getting cheaper and cheaper to get to where the Clean Power Plan was headed. That is only going to be true for a certain amount of time. At the end of the day, when we get particularly into the late 2020s, and certainly by 2030, if you want those emissions to continue to go down, and if we're going to get anywhere close to where we need to be under the science, we need a federal policy in place. But the fact that the trajectory is going there in the near term was a part of that context of that argument. It'll be similarly a part of the context of an argument if, say, the Trump administration goes out there with a policy, a replacement policy for the Clean Power Plan that says we can only get very tiny, tiny, tiny emission reductions from this sector, and we can only do it in, you know, a certain constrained way. Part of the context of that case and part of the arguments that will be made is you're ignoring the reality of the world where very significant emission reductions are being achieved cost effectively through the function of the power system itself.
Without an EPA rule. I mean,
Jeff, right? Could I finish?
Yes.
Thank you. So if you're saying to the court, this is the reality of the world, and EPA is ignoring the reality of the world, that is an argument for why whatever EPA has done is not the best system of emission reduction, because it's not best. It's not reflecting the real world, it's not as cost-effective, and it's not getting where you want to go in terms of emission reductions. Jeff, please.
Okay, it is 3:13. If you can make your question really fast.
Sure, and it follows on her. I'm Vicki Arroyo with the Georgetown Climate Center, and I'm just picking up on where the last question left off, because there are a number of states, but they're not all of them. So just sort of help Megan maybe answer Jeff's question. So about 15 states, we helped, you know, comment on the rule, helped to create it, because they said our experience is the best system is truly the electricity sector as a whole, the electricity system. And, you know, it didn't carry the day with these folks. But I guess my question to Jeff is, on a partisan basis, pretty much, you know, Congress tried and failed to get legislation through. Mass versus the EPA says it is a problem, we've got to deal with it. The Clean Air Act is a way to do it. What do you think is a common sense solution that could be supported by members of your party if it's not, you know, something like a Clean Power Plan? Because we know that it's only going to get a fraction of the reductions that we need to deal with this challenge, right? So what is the path forward?
None of these arguments are really relevant to the legal question, which is, when you're talking about the best system of emission reduction, are you looking at something that applies to the power grid as a whole, or are you doing what EPA has done for 40 years and you're looking what can control emissions at an individual plant? So that's the legal issue, and whether the, you know, whether the system is heading in one direction or the other is not really relevant to that issue. I think at the end of the day, this is an issue that has to be decided by Congress. And people say, well, that Congress will never do it. I don't think that's true. I think that ultimately this kind of a policy under our constitutional system is something that is not invented by a single regulatory agency trying to be creatively read a statute that was designed for something else. This problem is something that Congress needs to step up and develop. And people will say, well, Republicans are in charge, they'll never do anything. I don't think that's true. I think there's an opportunity to do something through Congress. Now, I do think... I do think that that's not easy. I do think it requires kind of the right political moment. And the last time we had any kind of major legislation like this, dealing with these very same issues, with the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, and I was actually in the White House back in those days in the first Bush administration. And at the time, I didn't realize how unusual that was. But the administration actually showed leadership, not by calling on Congress to do something, but the administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, drafted several hundred pages of detailed legislative language. They put that forward and said, here's what we want you to do. And then they spent the next year and a half working with Republicans and Democrats and environmental groups and industry groups. And literally, there were four or five senior White House officials in the Bush administration who every day worked on the Clean Air Act. And when they thought their own constituency was being unreasonable, they pushed back. They said, and there's examples of that that have been well publicized. That's the kind of leadership that you need to do something like this. And that's where I am critical of the Obama administration. They certainly were supportive of what was going on, but they never did the kind of work that really would have made that happen. So I think that ultimately this issue has to be decided by Congress. And I also think that we're not going to regulate our way through this problem. And I don't mean to dismiss the usefulness of that, but ultimately this is a problem that's going to be solved by technology. And as long as the cheapest way to produce electricity in most of the world is coal, you're going to have coal that's going to continue to be burned. And so in addition to focusing on our part of the world, which is increasingly less important as the rest of the world grows, we ought to be looking at policies that can be put in place to support basic research into energy issues that we really haven't been doing very much of. So anyway, that's I didn't mean to pontificate for quite so long, but that's the way I when you ask what my party will do, I think that's the way it needs to be done.
All right. Well, thank you so much. My orders are to get you back into the ballroom immediately. So please do that. And let's thank Jeff, Megan, and Michael.